Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies. Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies. And our guest today wears many hats. He's an actor who you've seen many times. He's a director, producer, author. And all of those people are our guest today.
All of those people.
Yes. Are Bob Balaban.
But I'm not really
Welcome.
Schizophrenic.
No, never that.
I was looking at your bio and your credentials, and I realized that I saw your Broadway debut.
Wow.
Because I was taken to see Neil Simon's Plaza Suite. And that was, in fact, your first Broadway show, right?
It was. I was still in college, actually, at the time.
Huh.
And I had been in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. I was the original Linus in that when I was in my junior year.
Yes. That's what to put him on the map first.
I love that show.
It wasn't much of a map, but it does mean the casting directors who are looking around for young people find you in your off-Broadway show. So I was lucky enough to get to work with Mike Nichols and Neil Simon when I was about 21 years old.
And what I remember about seeing that play, I'd never seen a Neil Simon show before, was just the waves of laughter that greeted every line. Every other line was a punchline, and nothing missed. Nothing didn't hit the bullseye. What did that feel like for you on stage?
Good. It felt really good. what was interesting is in previews, and we had done it out of town, I think in Boston, I don't really remember. And then people liked it. It was clear that liking a Neil Simon show directed by Mike Nichols was kind of almost a routine thing because it happened year after year after year. But I will say that I did notice a real difference between being appreciated out of town and during previews. You know, it was very nice. Everybody was happy. And then once the reviews came out and the people had to pay trillions of dollars for their ticket and they were seeing the best show that ever was, their enjoyment factor just zipped up to 300% after that. And it was so much fun. And you described it as waves. It was wonderful. It was a big theater. And I used to come out in the beginning and say a few simple things with Maureen Stapleton. And they would start to laugh when they saw me coming in. Because, you know, a short person. You know.
Oh, my. The I can't imagine what that must feel like and how gratifying it must be.
Well, it was really fun, and even I, who was kind of an idiot about many things, was aware of the genius of Mike, the amazingness of Neil Simon. It was where I met Maureen Stapleton, and we remained friends for the rest of her life, and George Scott, who was amazing, and I went on to work with him a couple of times. I knew this was not something that was going to happen often. So it was quite exciting.
But that's a lot for a young person to understand, you know?
Yes.
It's easy to not, because you're so young, it's easy to not sort of be aware that this is normal. Oh, every show you're in gets these kinds of reviews and gets this kind of an audience reaction.
Well, that even I knew that probably wasn't true. Although I did ask Mike something. Opening night, there was a big party at the Plaza Hotel. Where else would the party be? And as we were walking over, Mike, maybe we were walking over to a pre-party. I said to Mike, "Well, what does it feel like to you know, have this amazing thing happening. And he said, well, I won't lie to you. I mean, I'm definitely very happy about it, but it's kind of becoming an occurrence in my life. Mm-hmm. I'm happy. I'm grateful. If it doesn't happen, I'll be tragically sad, but mm-hmm. it's not the same as it was on the first two. Mm-hmm. And of course, I mean, and he was just saying something honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
How many times can you have a similar experience and not get used to it, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Well, we just talked to Mark Harris a few weeks ago.
What a great book that was.
What a terrific book, and what a fascinating life. What a fascinating figure to try to penetrate and describe as Mike Nichols. Everything you say, I'm sure, is dead accurate, but it also bespeaks the fact that he was a lifelong neurotic.
Mm.
Well, we had the same therapist, oddly enough. Maybe I shouldn't be saying this, but a lot of people, when it's New York and, you know, there aren't that many places to go to therapists who specialize in creative people, actually. Mm-hmm. And I do think whatever he was neurotic about, he was totally entitled to be as neurotic as he needed to be, given his youth, given the escaping from the Nazis, yes. given mm-hmm. Given the situation, which now we can talk about. And a lot of people really didn't know it, but Mike did, the fact that he had lost every hair on his body, on his head, on his nostrils, I mean, everything. And as a child, he had to go around being a freak, basically. I also think it's part of what made him so resilient. I think it's part of what made his understanding of behavior so acute. This is a person who was not part of the party until he was about 17 or 18 years old, maybe 19. And he went around observing everything, you know, like almost like he had landed from another planet and he was watching behavior. I always thought of him as a scientist of behavior. The first day of rehearsal on Plaza Suite. And that was obviously very exciting. We were all watching. We did a little run through and then we sat in the audience and watched while Mike did an improvisation with George C. Scott and Maureen Stapleton, where all they did was, what was it like to enter to a hotel that you've never been in before? Mm-hmm. What's the first thing you do when you come in? What's it like? And he worked on that. Everything in Plaza Suite, the reason he was such a great combination with Neil Simon is Neil Simon was the powerhouse of jokes and story. Mike was the powerhouse of making it be real. This was not Neil's primary concern, and it's not a writer's concern. But so often when Mike wasn't directing, it was a Neil Simon play wasn't necessarily the same thing without a real behaviorist in charge, like Mike.
Yes, exactly. And just brilliant. You know your own credentials well enough.
Actually, I don't.
Well, so, I can fill you in.
Because you've worked a lot.
I'm here to help. That's all I do here. But it occurred to me that everybody who has worked a long time, you know, accumulates credits. And you have a lot of credits. But more than anything else, it seems to me that you actually were a part of history, only you don't know it at the time. It's not history while you're doing it.
I don't even know it now. So tell me about it.
But I mean, we're going to.
This is actually an episode of This Is Your Life. You're welcome.
But being a young actor and being a part of Midnight Cowboy, or being on location in Mexico with Mike Nichols again and others in Catch 22, working for Steven Spielberg alongside Francois Truffaut in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, being in the Christopher Guest movies that we all love, being in the Wes Anderson movies, these are pieces of movie and show business and pop culture history.
Mm-hmm.
Does it strike you the same way, or is it just what you've done?
It's just what I've done. But but something does strike me. When I first started to work, they didn't show movies on television much. There was the Friday night movie.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And if you were in something, no matter what it was, a couple of years later, people didn't really know that movie. I mean, buffs did, but it's not like now. every single thing we do now has 20,000 platforms, and they never end, and you never say goodbye, which is great if you did a good job in the movie. But if you thought you stank, it's like, oh my God, that's going to be around for eternity.
It's back. Yes.
And it's a real shift in everything. This mm-hmm. people seeing every piece of work over and over and over again. It's interesting because you never think about the fact that a lot of great movies just got lost until 20 years later or 30 years later. And now nothing's lost too much thanks to Turner Classic and other things.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember your audition for Midnight Cowboy?
I remember it precisely, yes. I wasn't terribly experienced. I really had done one thing on film and Charlie Brown. You're a good man, Charlie Brown. So what a far cry from Midnight Cowboy. Was to be carrying a blanket and then God knows what else happened in Midnight Cowboy. I knew I was coming somewhere special, but I had no idea that this was going to be the place that was the font of my next like five jobs. Hmm. They were always looking for a new face, and I was mm-hmm. new for a while. I remember going in. I remember not knowing anything about the movie much. I remember going in and improvising, and I don't know. I wonder if I improvised with John. I bet you I did, because who else would I have been improvising with?
Yeah.
I never really studied acting particularly. I eventually studied with Uta Hagen, but I hadn't at that point. But I had studied at the Teenage Workshop at Second City in Chicago, because I'm from Chicago. So if somebody said the word improvise, it was like, oh, well, that's easy. I can do that. I couldn't do much else, but I could do that. And they said, now we're going to improvise. This is the situation. Can I say it even now on Zoom?
Yes, I know, hesitantly, but yes.
This is the situation, blah, blah, blah. And now this is the scene where he's trying to take your watch from you because you can't pay him. And we did it for 20 minutes. And it was extraordinarily fun and in a way very misleading to the director, because improvise, as I've come to know when I work with actors and I direct sometimes, improvising is sometimes much more exciting than when you actually have to say the lines that they've written for you. So anyway, it went beautifully. I left. I think they sort of said to me, you know, don't book October 12th or, you know, whatever mm-hmm. the thing was. And I left, and I remembered calling home, and I said to my parents, I think I got a job. I'm not sure. They said, what is it? I said, and I remember saying this, I can't believe I did. I said, I think it's some kind of TV movie. I'm not sure. And the irony of that, because every time Midnight Cowboy ended up being on TV, they always cut my part, because everybody else, they would cut some of their part. With me, they had to cut the entire thing.
Yeah, the entire thing. Yes.
And then it goes and wins the Academy Award for Best Picture. And suddenly it's not an R rating anymore. I don't know if you ever noticed that. They didn't change the picture. They didn't cut anything or change it. But now it was okay that there was crazy sex all over the place. It had an Academy Awards certificate of honorability, and it was no longer X-rated.
Huh. Amazing. And that film, you know, that film, I didn't appreciate. I was too young to get it when I first saw it. We're about the same age. And I was
too young to be in it.
Indeed. And John Voight was brand new. He was brand new.
He had done two things, and how brilliant of John Schlesinger to find him. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure somebody eventually would have, because he's a brilliant talent and he was very handsome and everything else. But brilliant that you could make a movie. That's the amazing thing when you think about it. This was a feature film for a major studio.
Yeah.
This was not some little off-Broadway experiment, you know, as a movie. This was a kind of movie, and they, how brave of them to do it. I actually believe it was a Paramount movie, and my uncle was at that point president of Paramount, and I'm sure they must have produced the movie, or he wouldn't have had it on his desk. I came in shortly before the movie opened to meet my uncle for lunch, and I went. He was at the Paramount building at that point. I mean, not at the Paramount, at the Gulf and Western building. He had been at the Paramount building. And I go up there, and there are all these cans of films, and, you know, stacked up on his desk. And I noticed that the Midnight Cowboy was sitting on his desk. And I didn't say anything about it, and he didn't say anything about it. We had a lovely lunch. And then I saw him about 4 months later, and I went to myself, oh, he never mentioned the movie. I guess I'm not going to bring it up, because I guess it shocked him. I mean, which it probably did.
Shocked a lot of people.
I guess it did. Yeah. But I didn't find it too shocking, but then I'm an actor. I know it's all fake.
Right. Well, it's so interesting you mentioned Second City. We just got to interview Richard Kind.
Oh, wow. I love Richard.
And he's fantastic. And it is amazing the improvers and the people who learn to do that. As you say, it's a real skill set. It is something that some people can do and some people can't. And it fascinates me now that there's a whole genre of films that rely on it so heavily.
Well, it's interesting. It's very hard. The strange thing is, I don't think there are very many successfully improvised movies. Mm-hmm. Not that there aren't sections, and a lot of directors, in fact, a preponderance of directors might even say, let's do the scene once where, you know, you kind of say it in your own words, you know, right, et cetera, which they don't even call it improvisation, but that's what it is.
It is, yeah.
And if you're a movie star, especially, you can get away with suddenly breaking into the soliloquy from Hamlet in the middle of your big moment. The directors don't really frown on it if you're not exactly above the title. But improvising as a rehearsal technique for movies is not an unusual thing to happen at this point. You know, the scene's not going well. If you're lucky enough to have a rehearsal, one of the first things that a lot of directors say is, well, you know, well, how would you say it? If they're brave.
Yeah. Yeah.
If they're ready for the results, good right. or bad. Yeah.
I mean, that's part of what makes the Christopher Guest films so special. And we are huge, huge, huge fans. But the cast and his, you know, the core group of you that he brings on each time, you're just the most ridiculously talented humans.
Well, Chris is to blame for a lot of this stuff. He has good taste. He knows who goes well together with what mm-hmm. people. And also, he never asks you to be funny. The experience is so unique. He never, if you want to talk about it, you can call him after you read the Bible, which is usually about this big. And it, you know, it will say they're having a dog show. These people now are taking their dog for a walk. That's the scene. So he doesn't even do a rehearsal take. You know, usually when you're shooting a movie, it's like, let's do one for the camera. Well, you can't do one for the camera because nobody knows what's going to happen. So, but he used the same camera people over and over again, and they got pretty instinctive about what was happening. But the very first time you said anything was when the camera was rolling. It mm-hmm. is the most freeing experience you could possibly imagine. I guess you could either be scared, but this is one of the first times I really did come to believe it is possible that when you get that shivery thing in your legs, that it's excitement. It's not necessarily fear. It was thrilling. And everybody in it listened to everybody else. Nobody tried to hog anything. I mean, the danger of improvisation is there's some word hog in the group, or that somebody starts writing their own movie when they're doing it.
Right.
It's literally, it's so zen-like. It's improvisation basically is all about listening to other people. So if everybody's listening to everybody else, how does anything come out? It just does.
Can you describe that Bible, that sort of blueprint that you work from? That now that's written by Chris and Eugene Levy usually, yes?
Yeah. It says very simple things. It gives you a hint when, because all the major characters usually anyway have a little speech about themselves that they have to give, because, you know, periodically he's going to cut to you saying something, and he will give you a little hint as to what he's got in mind for the character. This doesn't mean you're going to have to do it. I know, for example, that in A Mighty Wind, he said something about my character. He didn't say much about it. He doesn't say much about your character because you're already your character for the most part in some way, I suppose. But I remembered reading that my mother was so protective of me that she used to make me wear a helmet when I played chess in case I fell on the bishop. But he did not really put jokes into these things. But when you see a good joke, it's like, you know, and it didn't just give me something to do in my thing where you're only the only person and he asks you questions. It was the complete key to my character. Mm-hmm. I didn't ever think about it. I didn't plan on having a key to my character, but all I knew is I was afraid of everything. So I was afraid. I don't know. There's a scene in the movie, which if you're fans, you might remember, but I mean, you know, no normal person would remember this, where I become so annoying to one of the other actors with my fear. I don't want to stand in certain places. I want him to take away some flowers because they're long and they're on the floor and people who have canes might get caught up in them and there could be a lawsuit about it. And it was so easy for me because I am sort of afraid of everything. So I tapped into it right away. I never would have thought of it if he hadn't have written that down. And towards the end, it turned out to be the end of the scene following because I was on stage with the man whose nemesis I was, who was trying to organize things. And I was being very resistant to organization. I remember pointing at the ceiling in the theater and saying, are those lights well attached? Because it appears as though if they fell on you, there's nothing in between you and the light. And he was sort of standing a foot or two behind me, whacked me on the head with the pile of papers that he had, and I fell to the ground. It was completely, that was it. It's like, no more, the scene's over, done. Thank you, goodbye. And why was I saying that? Well, because that's, but none of this was in the,
right.
None of this was in the description. It would be, he's in six locations. Bob is in six locations with his friend. And then they put us there. And then you just talk. And you can do another take. And you can change everything if you want to. You don't do it to be arbitrary. In one take in some other movie that we were doing together, Eugene, it was a boring scene. You know, it was a necessary scene. Most of the scenes aren't really necessary for the plot. They're just necessary to see everybody and see what people are doing. But this was a plot-driven scene. The press were taking pictures. That's all I dimly remember. And a panel of us were being sort of interviewed. And Eugene is an amazing everything. He's an amazing person. He's an amazing actor. He's an amazing funny person, but he can be serious. And I noticed that we had a lot of takes because there were so many people and they wanted to do coverage, which they don't do that much of in these movies. But I noticed that Eugene had easily fallen into, it was as if he had taken the script home and memorized it for a month. Suddenly, he was able to say everything he had said in the previous take. He said again, but it didn't sound like he was repeating anything. It was just had been so naturally arrived at that it was easy. And then after about the eighth take, without a single word, it's time for Eugene to talk, or this is the scene where he sort of says that something, and he completely changed everything. And he didn't do it because he didn't do it because he felt like changing something. He was so relaxed and so comfortable that when he opened his mouth, other things came out. It's like that. It's like when that happens, it's like a dream for everybody because we got it electrifies the whole thing because you know he's not doing it because he's sitting there going, what could I say now that's funny? He's just doing something so organic that it gives, it's thrilling. It's a little thing, but it's thrilling.
It's not a little thing. It's who he is. I have to say it has been, it's such a joy for him and for Maureen O'Hara. It's Maureen O'Hara.
Well, she's good too. I love her.
Who
would have been a great improviser if she had had a chance.
Catherine O'Hara, the two of them having this time with Schitt's Creek being so popular and then winning all of these awards, it is absolutely the greatest. It just brings me so much joy. Because
Eugene and Catherine, as you know, are really best friends.
Yeah.
And they
yeah.
have been working together since the beginning of improvisation in Canada, anyway. And the idea that they get to do a lot of other different things, be in all the Chris Guest movies, sometimes vis-a-vis each other, always somewhat vis-a-vis. And then they get to have these 5 or 6 years of I hate to be religious here, but it's kind of a blessed experience that you get to work with your best friend whose son has been writing it and is having a transformative experience becoming a tremendously successful person. And he seems to have come from nowhere except he had a really funny father.
Yeah.
And a good father.
Yeah. No, it thrills me that people who didn't know them now.
Yeah.
People who only knew Eugene from American Pie, you know.
People mostly don't know the people from those movies. And then once in a while, like Jane Lynch got furiously successful and continues to be.
Right.
But it doesn't really happen that way so much. Part of the reason you're improvising is everybody isn't so familiar with you. You don't really find established movie stars in improvised movies. Now, they don't pay you, so that may be one reason you don't get found in those things. But there are other reasons too. And usually, when Robert Altman made MASH, there was a script, but Robert is very easy with improvisation. And there were a lot of times in there with characters who had absolutely no lines, who carried the scenes. That doesn't happen it wasn't a major Hollywood movie until it was over. And then it turned out to be this fantastic success. It was a little disposable movie for Fox. They weren't even going to open it necessarily. But Bob had the genius to know that it wasn't just Elliot Gould and Donald Sutherland who was there. Everybody who was cast in the movie came from a major background of improvisation. Did you know that? They rated everywhere. Well, there weren't that many places except Second City.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know that they had Groundlings at that point or anything else. But even when we did Gosford Park, it wasn't that it was an improvised movie, but it often felt like an improvised movie because Bob encouraged people in any group scenes to say whatever they wanted to say if it wasn't carrying the plot and you didn't... There's a scene in Gosford Park where we're all going out for a pheasant hunt. And there must have been 20 of us. It was like the entire cast. Everybody gets their own microphone so you can say whatever you want. And the camera's 1,000 feet away. So, you know, they don't even notice that you're talking. And it wasn't even that he set up for us to do anything, but we all started after a take or two, just chatting with each other. But, you know, you try to chat in character in some form, or else you're really serious about it. I don't remember whether I was serious or not, but I didn't even remember saying this, but I went to see the movie and my character comes out and has a really good joke, but I hadn't even remembered saying it, nor had it been written. I simply looked at the person next to me and said, "Are pheasants ever dangerous?" And literally there it was from Christopher Guest 5 years earlier. The fear of everything is often a good trope.
Good motivator, yes.
Yeah.
And we should put a big asterisk here that not only are you in Gosford Park, but you also produced Gosford Park and got an Oscar nomination for doing so.
That's true. Yes, actually, amazingly so, it's true. And it didn't even seem that hard. I mean, it is very hard to get a movie made anyway, but I was sitting in my office looking to the next year and going, I've been cast in this thing here for 2 weeks, this other thing here for whatever. What if nothing happens? I've got to be more motivated. I've got to be busier at this thing. So I happened to be reading some Agatha Christie murder mysteries. And I'd known Robert Altman since I met him for Brewster McCloud when I was about 23 years old. I had a meeting with him. And then I had other friends who knew him. And Bob was very, very inclusive. So I was in the regular list of people that went to watch the dailies for his movies because Bob was not very particular about, most directors are, may my beloved mother who's 98 and is dying tomorrow, may she come to the rushes? No, she can't come. For Bob, it was like, oh, you know somebody, the man who picks up your garbage? Oh, yeah, sure, have him come. So I used to come to, I knew Bob enough to be able to call him at one point and say, I have an idea. Would you be interested in hearing about it? And all of a sudden, everything started falling into place. I had known Julian Fellowes for about 3 years before that. I don't think he'd ever sold a script before. And he was an actor primarily, but of course he was a brilliant person and was just as fully formed then as he is now, but nobody knew it. And I ended up saying, well, Bob, if you really want to make this movie, Bob said, and Bob and I agreed, it must be a British writer. And he didn't really know any British writers. And I said, I know this guy. He can't send his resume because he doesn't have a resume, basically. But I've worked with him. I think he could be the person who does this thing. And the short of it is after about a year and a half from having that dinner with Bob, when we talked about the movie, there we were in London doing the movie, which is so unusual, especially you know, to find a world-class director and a writer who becomes a world-class writer. Needless to say, it hasn't happened again with me that easily. Anyway, I've done other things, but this was so misleading and so exciting for all of us.
Now, you experienced, you had another kind of experience, I gather, being in Mexico with Mike Nichols and company shooting Catch 22. How long were you there? Do you recall?
7 months.
Oh, wow. God.
Everybody
That's
was
a
there
long
forever.
Shoot.
Yes, and my character is in maybe 8 minutes of the movie. Maybe it might be 10. I don't know. Of course, I was very happy to be anywhere and to be continuously employed for 7 months when you're, you know, when you've just graduated college a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
And thrilling to be with all those people. When do you, I mean, every person I admired was in that movie, and a number of them, we all became friends, some of us over time. I wouldn't compare it to COVID. I would say there was an awful lot of waking up in your hotel room going, what am I going to do today? And most of us were covers, which means that if it rains, they got to have you around because they can't plan that scene's going to happen. And it's so expensive to have a day where there's nothing you can shoot because there's an exterior. So basically, I spent a lot of time wondering whether it was going to rain and meeting some nice people. And I had one great thing that happened during it. I had been a very heavy smoker all of my childhood, you know, starting at about 15 or 16, because everybody I knew was smoking all the time. And when this was the first time I'd ever been on location, I had been doing The Midnight Cowboy. I shot over 3 or 4 different days spread out over 4.5 months. So I can't quite remember if it was intersecting, but that was my experience in a movie, me and one other person for, you know, one day at a time for a while. This thing was a cast of thousands. It had airplanes. It had Porfirio Rubirosos, B-52 bomber, because they had to go collecting B-52 bombers. So the experience was enormous, but also very sort of tedious. And yet there you were with Art Garfunkel and Paul Simon writing the boxer in the next two rooms while you're there. And then there's Orson Welles for his 10 days and Anthony Perkins. And it was exciting and boring, mm-hmm. and great to be with Mike, who the movie has now come into non-disrepute. I mean, people, you know, like it. I think Mike, even time went on and on and on, and it came to be that this movie was considered really an interesting movie that broke some ground in a very exciting way. And it was nice that Mike got to enjoy that. But at the time, MASH had come out, I think a month or two before Catch 22, and the expectations of a movie that we can't remember now. You can, Leonard and I can remember, but you can't imagine that there was once a book that captured the entire United States at the same time and held on to them for years, because it was all about the war in Vietnam, but it wasn't about the war in Vietnam. It was everybody knew all the characters' names. They knew what they said. They knew how they had their own idea of what they looked like. It was impossible to fill people's expectations. And then MASH comes along, which was a disposable movie that Fox was going to throw away. And without telling the whole story, they had a required legal screening to screen MASH. They sat down, Robert was there, whoever was in charge of things at Fox, literally said to Robert something like, we have to see this movie, but we're probably not going to release it. Don't be upset. It'll be in the library or whatever. And at the movie, there wasn't a word for the first 10 minutes. And the executives are all, this is from what Bob told me at one point, he's listening to them all whispering, see, there are no laughs. It's not happening. It's not working. It was only because people were so fascinated. By the end of it, it grew and it grew and it grew. And there was a 10-minute standing ovation. It had so captured the moment of war and the moment of Vietnam in a way that Catch 22 could never have fulfilled it, no matter what it did, because everybody had a preconceived notion about it.
Right.
It disarmed Catch 22.
Hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway.
Maybe undercut is the word.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and at one point, Mike, I think other people have said this, and it may have been in books, so it's not a terrible thing to say. And he never showed this, you know, because he could always be, he was always on top of his game, whatever it was. But you didn't see the anxiety, especially for those first years. Remember, he'd had how many years? 10 years of success with Neil Simon. Then he had Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And then he had The Graduate. This was the first time he started to feel like he was failing. And he was 35. He had started when he was like 21 or 22. And I know at one point, I believe I heard him say it, he came from Dailies and said, I'm giving birth to a stillborn, is what he felt. And he tried everything. And he made a really good movie, but he didn't know it when he was there. And I suspect other people didn't really know it. But you never know what's going on with a movie until it comes out. You never know.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many pieces. I mean, and that's, again, with things being as accessible as they are now, I think people are more aware of all of the parts and who does what. You know, I don't think people for a long time understood what an editor did in a very literal sense.
Most people think there's just one shot. They don't think it's broken. The experience of the movie is they just took a picture and they made the movie.
Yeah.
But even more, especially with comedies, with tragedies, it's a little easier because a tragedy feels like a tragedy.
Right.
But funny movies, especially the really funny movies, don't necessarily seem like funny movies until there's somebody else watching them. Because if you're going to get used to the funny part right away, and hopefully it's no more funny to you, but you know enough, you're just going to keep trying to make it be funny. Right. And it won't be funny or not until an audience tells you.
Mm-hmm.
Which is scary.
Listening to Mike Nichols being interviewed by Steven Soderbergh on the DVD audio track of Catch 22.
Well, that's a rarity. I didn't hear that.
You see, he didn't hear that.
I mean, you would observe it in a different way than I did, but to hear Mike Nichols 35 years after the fact, revisiting his own somewhat notorious flop, which is what it was at the time, and re-examining it, being prodded to do so by Steven Soderbergh, is just fascinating. And
what a great thing. I must go out and find it somewhere.
It is worth finding.
He's very useful for these. but you're in a film that I love, 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 and talk about as much as possible because I want everyone to see it, Cradle Will Rock.
Oh, wow.
I love that movie.
It's a great movie. I think nobody went to see it, but Tim did a great job.
It's on TV a lot, which is great. But it's just one of my favorite movies. It is so good. And the cast is ridiculous. It's so many talented people. And I mean, you have Alfred Molina, one of the greatest actors that exists. You know, you have both Cusacks. You got a Joan and a John. Now, I can't imagine for you, you're just talking about Orson Welles. Well, now you're in a film that has, you know, someone playing Orson Welles.
Yeah.
I hope that you enjoyed making that movie.
I did. It was rushed because it was for what it accomplished, it was a very low budget movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
A very complicated movie. Yes, it was wonderful. Tim's great. And I got to, I really had fun. Sure. I generally have fun unless I'm in agony. And then if I'm in agony, you wouldn't know it. Hopefully.
Well, at what point did you decide you wanted to at least try directing?
Joe Papp asked me to direct a play at the Public Theater. I had done three or four plays for Joe. My favorite one being The Basic Training of Pablo Hummel, which is a David Ray play that's just staggeringly good. I replaced it at Pablo Hummel and had a great time. And Joe came to me and asked me to direct a play. And I was so flattered that I did, and I hated it. I didn't like the experience. I was like, oh, well, you have to listen to all these actors. I want to be the one who's talking, you know, whatever. And it was a difficult experience. So I kind of dropped all interest in being in a play. This was probably when I was about 27 or 28 years old. I was so knowledgeable. I knew what I wanted. And at one point, I did a Sidney Lumet movie called Prince of the City. And most of what happens to me is usually my wife's idea. I must confess that. I think she said this. She said, why don't you apprentice yourself to Sidney Lumet and learn how to be a director? And I was like, oh, okay, I could ask him that. And I did, and I apprenticed myself to him. And it was remarkable. I mean, I had been around, you know, a fair amount at this point, but to actually watch a director directing, and you're not the actor, so you get to see everything in front of the camera, behind the camera, the preparation, the post-work. I was there for everything, including the editing process. My wife then said to me, well, it's your birthday. Here's a little script for a short film that I wrote. You should direct it. And I did. And I, for whatever reason why I had hated being a director 3 years before, simply walking out and seeing some actors in a camera, I thought, this is what I want to do. I've got to do more of this. Of course, I haven't done that much of it, but I have done some of it since then. It was just a really transforming experience. And the movie was at a film festival, the New York Film Festival, which was shocking. And I got a job directing a pilot called Tales from the Dark Side, which ran for like 50,000 years. And I started getting work as a director. And for a fair amount of my life, I've alternated between directing plays occasionally, acting more of the time, and once in a while directing TV episodic or making a couple of movies. So I'm much happier being multifaceted because, for one thing, you get to work more. I mean, that's probably the best thing about it. Yeah. The more opportunities you could have a job. But I also like it because it gives you, it's nice to understand what you're doing from multiple points of view. It can't be, but helpful. It immediately stopped me from doing something I probably did in my first play, which is explaining too much to the actors before anything happens. It's like, don't talk, let them see what's happening. Just tell them the smallest thing that you can think of, because anything that you say to them, I realize now as an actor, actors are sponges. If you, God forbid, you should say to an actor, now, he's got an anger problem, but this was like 20 years ago, but suddenly you're raging all the time. I mean, it's very dangerous. And I learned, you know, and you do learn stuff, and it's fun. So that's what happened then.
Well, I can't imagine apprenticing to Sidney Lumet.
Well, actors get the chance to meet a lot of great people, even if you're just a character actor. You still know the people. You often get phone numbers. And I loved Sidney. I had a great time with him in Prince of the City. I mean, I felt I was terrible in the movie, but that's, you know, we're allowed to think that. It's okay as long as too many other people don't think that, it's fine. And Sidney didn't think so. He was so wonderful to watch. Without me asking him, and I wasn't like his closest friend or his dearest movie star friend or anything, I was just a person. He explained everything to me. I didn't ask for that. And he was so busy. I made a book where the script was on one side, and I did a diagram of how the shots were on the other side, whether it was a tracking shot or what lens was being used. I had no idea why or what, but I wanted to keep a record of it. So I paid attention. So it didn't just become me watching the actors, which is the easiest thing for me to be doing. And Sidney explained everything. There was a shot that, and he would usually do 1.5 takes. I mean, he did nothing. He didn't even shoot the whole thing. He would shoot, I'm doing your close up here, then I'm doing a 2-shot for the middle part of the scene. This had come from his early days when studios couldn't recut him because there was nothing to recut. He cut it the way it had to be, and he did that. So he explained to me at one point, and the reason we had to do 7 takes, which like in a normal movie, that's not a lot of takes.
Right.
He said, I'm using a very long lens, so the focus is much more critical. So to keep us in focus for the whole shot, and I'm using it in one shot, I had to do it 7 or 8 or 9 times because we couldn't make any mistakes. And some of the tools are different now. It's somewhat easier to remain in focus because there's machinery that can sort of tell the lens what it's doing, but you know, it's still easy to be out of focus.
My dad has a moviola, and one of my favorite things to do when friends would come over and they would be complaining about something like Final Cut Pro was to walk them out to the moviola and go, tell me again how hard it is to do this on your computer. This is a moviola.
I directed a couple of movies before they had, you know, before it was digital. I mean, it was always not digital. And you get used to the fact that, wait a minute, where's that frame where you hear the word, we have to like search every piece of footage from the last 10 years in order to find something this big that somebody sneezed and it blew on the floor. I mean, what a world. And there are still, I don't know if they're still there. I used to know a few directors who could only work on film because you get to watch it over and over again. It's one thing to be able to go put the middle here, put the end here, use the take from here and there. You get very facile with it. And then one of the things that surprised me, I don't have the greatest memory in the world, but you start knowing your footage so well that you can literally say to an editor who knows the footage better than you even do, but the fifth take where the pigeon flew, I want to have that moment there, but I want to put this here and put that there. It's so easy to do. It used to require 25 assistants, but it still is just as hard to edit well. It doesn't.
Of course,
it's like everybody can make a movie on their iPhone, but you know how many people are George Cukor? I mean, you know, it's not so much.
Ken, is there any way to fairly ask you to summarize your experience on Close Encounters of the Third Kind?
Yes, I had a great experience. The whole thing from beginning to end was exciting. I got to watch Spielberg, Steven, who I had never met him before then. And I obviously read about him and knew, but he wasn't the fully, he didn't have the powerhouse behind him that he grew to have after the next one or two and a half movies. In fact, at one point in the movie, there's a place where the mothership goes, bum, 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 boom. And all the glass breaks in the little, they're not tents, but they're the little houses that we all live in on top of the Devil's Tower. And Steven wanted to do another take. It was like, no, you can't. The movie's already like $1.50 over budget. You can't do that. So Steven had to buy the glass. It wasn't real. It was, you know, sugar glass. Right. So he could have more shots of this thing breaking. That's the level, you know, he hadn't conquered the world yet. He was about to. His talent just, you can't even talk about it. So it was a wonderful thing to be with him. I love special effects. I was a puppeteer and I loved making scenery and I loved when I could make explosions in my puppet show. And I just loved special effects. So I loved when the little children came out and flew on the strings. All the little ETs that came out were 7-year-old dance students. I wrote a book about the thing called it used to be called The Close Encounters Diary. And it became Spielberg, Truffaut, and Me, which is the making of the movie book. It was a dream. Richard was always a friend of mine, and we got to be much better friends on that movie. Everybody, it was just a dream of an experience. Standing next to François Truffaut for, again, 7 months, standing next to François Truffaut, he didn't like to speak English. He barely knew any English, but he didn't want to lose his cool. He didn't want to... be fumbling around. I didn't know French. So I'll tell in a 2-second story, when they auditioned me, I didn't have to audition. It wasn't many lines. It was just that you said whatever Truffaut said in French, you had to translate it into English and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So the audition.
Just to explain for those who don't recall, Bob plays Truffaut's English interpreter. Continue.
And interestingly enough, in the first cut of the movie, I was an interpreter. In the second cut of the movie, I was a map maker before I was an interpreter. So to sort of maybe explain why my French wasn't really all that good since I was being an interpreter. So I go to the audition and it's all very jolly and Julia's there. I think, and Steven was certainly there and maybe Richard was there. He said, well, just say a few things in French. And I said, il y avait beaucoup d'années depuis que j'ai parlé français. Si vous me donnez ce boulot, ce sera très difficile pour moi. It's been many years since I've spoken French. And if you give me this job, it will be very difficult for me. Nobody in the room spoke French. They said, great, you have the job. And I immediately went to Berlitz. I'm not kidding. I gave them the movie script, which was very dangerous because it said, Bob Balaban, do not show this to anybody. So they could only read the script when I was sitting with them. So it was really expensive. We spent a lot of time. They translated everything into French. I end up in Gillette, Wyoming. It was crazy. And I'm introduced to François Truffaut. And I say in my most halting of French, I'm your interpreter, but I don't really know how to speak French. And he thought it was a riot. And instantly it was like, oh, he's not scary. He may be like the best director in the world, but he's just like a really nice person. He just doesn't talk that much because he doesn't like to speak English. And we struck up a friendship because he had nobody else to talk to. And by the end of it, I really could speak pretty much fluent French, although he described it as very formal French. It was kind of like somebody from the 18th century speaking French. But it was, again, you look back at 1,000 things you did, whatever field you're in, and there are only a few that are extraordinary, and yet you still had a pretty good time most of the time. But there are some things that I never get tired of talking about it. In fact, it's very boring. It's hard to get me to stop talking about it. It was a dream experience. Truffaut and I had no idea that it was going to be this mega hit. We just knew that we were always hot. The lights on Devil's Tower and the set were just excruciating, and we often had to be in these modules. They were, you can't air condition on a thing, and they couldn't air condition the set. It was so big. It was the largest airplane hangar in the world. Originally, we were going to shoot all the interiors, which is 80% of that movie, or a huge amount of time is spent in the interiors, in London. Then they had to go and find a bigger soundstage in Mobile, Alabama. So that's where we were. And it was so big that they couldn't air condition it because they were afraid it might incur a weather condition and have clouds and have rain on us. So it couldn't be air conditioned. So there, all we're doing is mop, how they come out between takes and things.
Right.
Sponges and come out and like wipe us down. It was a dream.
Wow. Jeez.
All
right. I'm making a left turn now, sharp left turn.
Okay.
Could you please describe for us not just the experience, but the environment of making a Wes Anderson movie?
Oh, great. It's its own animal. There's nothing else like it. You feel like you're doing, in one way, you feel like you're doing a student film, because it feels like, they are relatively low budget for the amount of things that they do in them. But you're also aware that there's this person at the center of it who knows everything. But it's not like he's a boss or a bully. It's just he knows everything. He's planned it. It's in his head. He can deal with a change if there's something better that happens. But you feel like you're in the hands of who you're in the hands with. Because, by now we know Wes never fails. Every movie might gross a different amount of money, but there's nothing he does that's ever less than ingenious, says something about humanity that you've never heard said before. And his skill is so great that almost everything he tries to do turns out to be even better than it was when he was thinking of it. It just works so beautifully. And it's a wonderful experience. It's very unusual. It's very egalitarian. One of the things about many of the best directors, and some of the ones that I've worked with were certainly great, there is a pecking order, of course, because if you're really famous, you don't have to go until the rehearsal's over, and then you just come in and do your part. But great directors make everybody feel like they're the king of the king of the movie, or at least the king of the day in some way. And Wes is like that. He's great with people. He can get a six-year-old child who has to do something difficult to do it in a minute. He'll change the line. He'll change the dialogue. He'll change the scene. He'll shoot it differently. He knows how to get what he wants. Wes on set is the same as Wes offset, except maybe he laughs a little more offset. And I'm not saying he's not funny when we're working, but the focus is unendable, how he retains focus and his calm and his intelligence. And always you're happy to be part of it. One of the happiest things I ever had in a movie was Moonrise Kingdom. My character was in the water with up to 10, I was in 5 feet of water standing on a rock with a plank between me and the beach. I started talking. I released an air balloon that had to be released in a special way, and I couldn't lose the thing. Then there were 15 Boy Scouts 30 feet away from me landing in a canoe, getting out of the thing. I had to watch them. I had to talk continuously. I had to walk on the plank, land on the bank, then notice something happening over there, get out a wind machine to check the wind. This is all one take. We started doing it at 5:30 in the evening. because of the balloon that I was letting go had light in it. I don't know why it was a lighted balloon, but it was to light the scene, basically. And they couldn't be sure how to set the focus because they wanted to be able to notice that it was dark enough so the light would show, but it can't be so dark that you can't see the actors or the scene because there was huge depth of field necessary. And we did this over and over, starting at 5:30, finishing at about 9 o'clock, the same shot over and over and over. And it was a couple of pages, so it wasn't like a waste of time. It was so much fun. It felt like I was in a permanent loop of a Wes Anderson movie, and I thought, I want to live here. If you told me to do this again for the next 3 days and not go home, it was so much fun. You could hone every little I and T and every look and every smell. It was just, it's wonderful working for people who know what they're doing and are really talented and are lovely people.
That's the first time we met him a long time ago now. I was so pleased that he was so nice. He was really sweet and kind, and that thrilled me because I feel like that comes through in his movies, that there is a sweetness.
It is part of the greatness of them all, is that they mostly, without looking like it, exude a kind of affection between most men. Not just all the characters aren't all affectionate, but you can feel his love.
Yeah,
I took him to meet Stanley Donen when Stanley was alive, and we had this little meal together, and it was so much fun. It was like the new world meet the old world, and I was just sitting there watching, and Wes knew he's a Marty Scorsese in that category of total extreme knowledge of everything that's ever happened. And I don't think Stanley knew who he was, but he was happy to see him. And I knew both of them. So I could say to Stanley, he's a very famous director. You may not know. And it was just like old meeting young. And I thought, that's almost as good as being in a great movie, watching the two of them.
Well, how special that you could make that happen.
Yeah, everything was special about it. Yeah.
Lovely. You didn't think to ask the two of us to eavesdrop?
Well, actually, I can probably get them both together again, and you could do a little Zoom call with them, except Stanley's dead. But you could have.
Small part. He's no longer with us. But
he did get to be about 95, so that's good.
Ken O'Hara, it's a long life. Now, I do want you to share, because before we started recording, you asked if Bob remembered the first time that you two met.
Oh,
yes. Well, it was in 1980, either late 82 or early 83, that, separate of each other, Bob and I were both invited to vote on the quarterfinals of the Student Academy Awards for that year. And we did it at NYU, and we screened a bunch of short films. And one of those short films so stood out. It was so clearly the work of someone who was well on their way toward having a voice, an individual voice. And that fellow was Spike Lee.
And we voted for him.
We voted for him, and the short called Joe's Bed-Stuy Barbershop, We Cut Heads, went on to win the Student Academy Award. And Spike owes us, man.
Yeah, right.
Well, he sends me a check every year. He doesn't send it to you?
Oh, wait a minute. Well, it must be. I moved a few years ago. Maybe
you got some money waiting for you.
But that's, for both of you, that is the crazy part of having worked for so long.
Well, I just knew that I knew Leonard forever. But right. I didn't know when forever started.
Right. I feel the same way. Mm-hmm. It is incredible. I always say careers fascinate me. And the names that you've mentioned, it's like legend after legend after legend after legend.
I suppose if I weren't me, I would have more of that experience of, oh, look who I met when I did. It just is like, you know, how was I in that movie? Oh, okay, I could have done this, I could have done that. But how many years? As like a 55-year trajectory?
Yeah.
Mostly I enjoy myself, mostly. And that's a good thing, you know.
Now, I could have started the interview or the conversation with this, but I'm now appending it to the very end.
I forgot they had telephones in this house.
When you were growing up, how aware were you of the fact that your family was, almost all of it, very much involved with the movie and theater business?
I would say I was aware of it, but I would also say that being a Midwestern Jew is to not want to make a big deal out of anything. It's part of the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't until years and years, well, the first time I got excited about anything, and you know, and they, well, I'll say it briefly because probably who would ever know this. My parents' family, my grandparents on my father's side fled Russia from a pogrom in about 1880, ended up on the slums of Chicago called Maxwell Street. And my grandmother in 1908, the year my father was born, went to see one of the earliest Nickelodeons in Chicago and decided to go into the movie business. This person who had grown up literally on a shtetl, they had a delicatessen, they sold one grape a year. I mean, they did nothing. There were 10 children, they were destitute. My grandmother said, we're going into the movie business. And within 17 years, they had built 125 theaters in the Chicago area. But it was of no consequence to me. You know, they were like two generations away because my dad's oldest brother was 24 years older than he was. So these were like my great grandparents. Needless to say, I never met them. So I was pretty much unaware of it, but I had a pass and I could go to movie theaters because they all said Balaban and Cats. Cats was my uncle, who later became my grandfather, but I don't need to explain, it's too boring. So all I was aware of was I could see movies for free, and my father himself, as the baby, had built a couple of the movie theaters and was in the television business. And it absolutely didn't seem like any form of a big deal in any way, shape, or form. My uncle, who is now my grandfather because he was married to my father's sister and then he married my mother's mother, he was the head of production at MGM. And I believe started the musical unit, something like that. And when I was 10, I broke my arm and nobody knew what to do with me. So they got on, my parents, God bless them, got on a train with me, the idea that they would take a train anywhere. And we sat in the Vista Dome and we went to Los Angeles, where I had never been before. And they brought me to MGM and there was a chair waiting for me with my name on it, a little director's chair. They were doing a movie called Meet Me in St. Louis with Sid Charisse and Dan Daly. It took place in a giant casino. I remember I loved scenery and my puppet shows had fantastic scenery, at least I thought they did. And I'm just in a candy store. It was so exciting. I start getting excited when I think about it right now. And this was this very realistic casino. There must have been 150 extras. It had big glass walls surrounding it and real cars in the soundstage outside the windows. And it was all very quiet. And all of a sudden they go action and everybody starts screaming, hit me, hit me. And the thing and all the 5,000 kinds of gambling are happening and everybody's screaming, the cars are going and then they yell cut and it goes like that. And I thought, okay, I'm imprinted. It's like, you know, I'm the baby duck who just saw somebody else who isn't really a duck and decided they had to be with them. And that's, I won't even say it, but I certainly had no talent when I began doing what I'm doing. I eked whatever little talent I managed to have once in a while out of nothing. But I just fell in love with the whole thing.
As who wouldn't, I must say.
Well, there are other people. My children don't. And are my children adore Wes Anderson because everybody loves Wes Anderson.
Right.
And my older daughter loves movies. But they're not, they don't want to come and watch me when I'm working.
They haven't been plunked down on a set with Dan Daly and Sid Charisse.
Yeah.
And that was Meet Me in Las Vegas.
Meet Me in Las Vegas. Because she had to put her hand, when she touched Dan Daly, he won. Mm-hmm. That was what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
It was a terrible movie.
Yeah, not a good movie. Not a good
but
movie.
But they play it once in a while and I get very excited.
Jeez.
Bob, it's such a treat to talk to you.
Well,
and you're very kind to let us exhume these memories.
These ghosts.
Well, the ghosts that are very much alive, apparently, in your head and your psyche.
Well, that's unfortunately true, but yeah, but it was, it, and you guys are a wonderful duo of interviewers. It's effortlessly fun and interesting, and you know, because we all over our lives get asked the same questions over and over and over again, but this wasn't like that. So thank you.
Oh, well, that's a very high compliment. Thank you very, very much. We followed the script. That's all.
And why is Hopalong Cassidy in the background? Did you know him?
My dad loves him. That's why. My dad loves him. We have Hoppy stuff all over the house.
I was doing something with Christopher Guest once, and I had to be a cowboy. I won't even explain it. It may have been cut from the movie, but I had to be a cowboy. And they found a wardrobe department that only had wardrobe from cowboys, and all of John Wayne's old wardrobe was in there. And I got to wear three outfits that John Wayne wore.
No way.
I mean, they had to like pin them in the back, but still. And there you are with Hopalong.
Like booze or no?
I'm sorry?
I said, they still smell like booze or no?
I have no response.
Okay.
are you to be found on social media, or you have better things to do with your time?
I'm on Twitter. I have the same 13,000 Twitter followers I've had since I went on Twitter. In the last 4 years, I decided it was immoral to Twitter anything that wasn't like important. So I have nothing to tweet that's important. I'm on social media, and my wife is trying to encourage me to be on Instagram. I'm still figuring it out, but I'm a little bit on Instagram. Why do you ask?
Because we like to, if people want people to know that they're out there, that service.
Mm-hmm.
Will you send me an email that says, how to identify how they would see this?
Yes, sir.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
You'll reach 13,000 people, which won't pay for breakfast, but yet they are people.
Well, there are 13,000 loyal, steadfast people that we know of.
They don't change even when I never tweet. I don't understand. I think they just like forgot about me.
No, they're loyal.
Unforgettable.
I choose to define them as loyal.
Well, what a nice thing to be doing. I would love to be able to do something with my daughter. And we occasionally do whatever it is together. One of my daughters helped me. I used to write children's books, and she wrote one of my children's books and was very helpful. But it was very joyful. So congratulations to you.
Thank you very, very much for saying that. And continued success in any or many of your future endeavors.
Thank you.
And we are on social media.
Indeed, we are. I am at Jesse Malton, and you are at Leonard Malton on Twitter and Instagram. You're also on Facebook. And you can also go to leonardmalton.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff.
And Patreon.
Maltreon.
Patreon.com/MaltonOnMovies is a way that you can help support and sustain what we do. And we appreciate those of you who've chosen to do that.
Immensely.
And we'll see you all next week.
Today's episode of Malton on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.